Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. The Museum of Fine Arts has apologized to a group of students of color from Dorchester who say they were profiled and harassed when they visited the museum last week. WBUR arts reporter Cristela Guerra has been reporting on this story, and she joins us now to tell us more about what happened. Cristela, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So for folks who may not have seen this story, this incident involved middle school students from the Helen Y. Davis Leadership Academy in Dorchester. What do they say happened?
So students and their teachers say security guards profiled and followed her class, made up of all students of color from gallery to gallery. She said guards seemed hyper-vigilant with her students, but kind of lax with other groups of mainly white students. Mm-hmm. And just before they left, when they were standing near an entrance, the teacher said that most of her group heard a woman walk by and loudly sort of exclaim, "Never mind, there's expletive black kids in the way." One other incident was a student who was kind of dancing to pop music inside the MFA's gender-bending fashion exhibition told the teacher that she heard someone say it's a shame that she is not learning and instead stripping.
Ugh, that's some pretty blatant stuff. And I'd also seen there were some reports that the students were given the museum rules in a very offensive way. Can you explain that?
So initially, I think the students thought they heard no food, no drink, no watermelon. It's been disputed and it's not been proven. Most of this are still allegations. But someone online said that it was a misunderstanding that what they said was no water bottles.
Oh, I see. Okay. So how were the students reacting, though, in the moment?
I mean, the teacher said that as they were leaving, there were some people crying, some kids that were really, really angry, and some silent, that they were just in shock. For a lot of these kids, it was their first time at the MFA.
And did the kids and teachers report this mistreatment that day, that very day?
So yes, the teacher said that she went up to museum staff. She gave them a rundown of everything she witnessed and what the kids said they experienced. And she said what she got in return was looks of pity and some tickets offered to come another day.
That was it in the moment. But this visit was a week ago. Mm-hmm. And so since then, the incident has gone very public. It's been everywhere. And we're talking about it here today. What's happened since?
Yeah, I mean, it went viral. You know, the teacher wrote on Monday a post on Facebook detailing their treatment. The museum says they contacted the school right afterwards. She says they contacted the school on Monday after her post went up. A week after, so yesterday,
today.
Yesterday.
Hmm.
Wednesday,
okay.
Yeah, the museum posted an open letter online apologizing for, and I quote, "the range of challenging and unacceptable experiences that made the students feel unwelcome."
Okay. So you spoke with the MFA and we reached out to join us here today, but they were unavailable. What are they saying about this incident beyond that statement?
So I spoke to Makiba McCreary, the Patty and Jonathan Kraft Chief of Learning and Community Engagement. She says she contacted the school soon after hearing, about half an hour after hearing about the incident. She said that both the museum and the school wanted to gather data and investigate. They're still in the process. But that's not really the most important part. That what really matters, she says, is that these kids had a negative experience and that the MFA has to reflect on how it contributed to making these kids feel unwelcome.
I would like to argue that it's even more so about what happens after that, which is ensuring that they know they belong here when they come into this museum, that they feel like it's their museum. And I approach that from both the perspective of a Boston resident, a mother of a young man of color who I want to make sure feels full agency to walk into this museum and own it in a really powerful way.
But of course, in hearing that, know that they belong here. Cristela, we've reported on this show and at WBUR, the museum has been having a bit of a reckoning over the last few years, acknowledging that it's a largely white institution in a rather diverse city and that there are people who don't feel belong there.
Right. So neither the museum's visitors or employee base reflect the city. In 2015, according to the MFA, 79% of museum visitors identified as Caucasian. 20% of the MFA's 700-plus member staff self-identifies as non-white. And of that group, only 14% are in the professional ranks, so like curators, conservators, educators, and leadership.
So that was 2015. Has the museum taken any steps to deal with that?
So in the letter, they mentioned that they're working on diversifying its staff so more visitors can see themselves reflected there. They offer free family memberships for newly naturalized U.S. citizens. And they said they're working on more inclusive, low-cost programming to attract kind of wider audiences.
And it costs how much to attend the MFA? About $20?
Give or take, yeah. Although it's free Wednesday nights.
And there are, of course, discounted afternoons and evenings. But, Christella, I want to ask you, because here in Boston, you know, we sometimes like to pat ourselves on the back for our history, and rightfully so, but it's also obviously much more complicated than that. And the lack of inclusion is built into our institutions and goes back to the origins of museums like the MFA. Is that right?
Yeah. So the 150-year-old MFA has been grappling with the same thing most Western encyclopedic museums are dealing with. This is a history and legacy of structural racism. It's not that museums, particularly encyclopedic ones like the MFA, are broken. It's that they were set up from a very specific perspective. They've historically served as institutional memory of world cultures from a white Western point of view rooted in colonialism.
We actually heard a little bit about that in the top of the show where we were at an archaeological dig in Roxbury. And Joe Bagley, the city archaeologist, said, you know, people choose to write history and it's written by certain people from a certain perspective. But the artifacts, perhaps, tell their own story. So I want to ask you, Christella, where does the museum stand right now?
There are clearly efforts to be more inclusive. But I think the museum realizes that it has a long way to go. Makeba McCreary, a woman of color herself, told me that she wouldn't have come on to work at the museum 5 months ago unless she knew that they were truly committed to effecting change.
You know, I think it shouldn't be lost on anybody that for me to agree to be here and to sign on to supporting this incredible mission, I had to feel like this was a culture that was going to be open to my beliefs and my values. And I think that's absolutely the case. I think that there's a full commitment from the director, Matthew Teitelbaum, and the rest of the leadership team to do better, to constantly do better. And it's really an iterative process. We learn as we go. And we also have to be accountable when we get it wrong. And we can't keep getting it wrong.
So we'll see if they can make good on that commitment.
Yes, we will. That's Christella Guerra, reporter for The Artery, WBUR's Arts and Culture Beat. Listeners, we would like to hear from you on this one. Has the museum handled this situation well? Is there a bigger societal problem with places like museums and other predominantly white institutions? Give us a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. And Christella, if you don't mind sticking around here for the rest of the show, because we're going to dive deeper into this story. Because for some folks, what happened at the MFA does not come as a surprise. As we just heard, museums have long struggled with diversity and inclusion, and the MFA is not immune. Again, in 2015, it reported that nearly 80% of its visitors were white. The museum has been trying to change that statistic through outreach, programming, and events. But as we've seen here, it's not always getting more people of color in the door that's the problem. Sometimes the problem is what happens when they get there. So I want to bring in two more folks into the conversation. One of them is Amanda Figueroa. Sorry if I butchered that. She's the co-founder of Brown Art Inc., which provides consulting and professional development to arts organizations, and she's a PhD candidate at Harvard. Amanda, thanks for coming in.
No problem. Happy to be here. It's Amanda Figueroa.
Figueroa. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Want to make sure I get that right. Mm-hmm. Also with us is Devin Morris, Director of Student and Family Engagement at Community Charter School of Cambridge. He's also the co-creator of the Teacher's Lounge, an event series for educators of color. Devin, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
So again, we reached out to the MFA, but they were not able to join us for this conversation today. But Amanda, I want to start with you. What was your reaction when you heard about this?
I heard about this news right on the heels of coming back from the American Alliance of Museums conference in New Orleans. This is the national conference for every museum in the United States and even internationally. And this exact incident has been on the minds of museum professionals for a long time. I think the field as a whole really understands that this is not just a possibility, but it's something that actively happens in the world every day, every week that that these organizations are operating. So, you know, you're always shocked. You're always like kind of devastated, but not that surprised.
So Renee Graham, she's a friend of the show and columnist in the Boston Globe. She wrote today, For years, these children and their teachers will bear memories of what should have been a joyous class trip like a scar, and it will always sting like a fresh wound. And Devin, I want to ask you, you know the teacher whose students were on this visit to the MFA. How was she dealing with this?
So we had limited interactions, but I think the first thing that I sort of reached out to see was how was the school caring for her so that she could best care for her students. And it sounds like things were heading in the right direction with regard to how the school, how promptly the school addressed this with regard to holding the MFA accountable in support of both the teacher who was present and the students who were present.
And what are the conversations that you're having with fellow educators and students and educators of color and white educators about this?
Sure. So our students actually were headed to the MFA today. And so we, knowing this was had hit news, knowing that it had been sort of spread far and wide, we wanted to have some conversations, continued conversations that we had already been having, but that were more specific to this visit today, that was continuing to push students and teachers to speak their authentic truth. The best thing that you can do is to share your truth and be honest about this so that you can talk through your experiences. And I think what often happens when we talk about adults having these difficult conversations, specifically surrounding race, is that we think that we need to be the expert on the discussion topic. And the best thing you can do as an adult having these conversations, tough ones, about students is to listen and share your authentic truth.
And so what is the authentic truth that you're hearing from them?
Unsurprisingly, students shared that this was not shocking to them when they heard the news. It is a shared experience that both educators of color and students have in many of the predominantly white institutions that we step into. And so students shared experiences of being in convenience stores and being overlooked and sort of shadowed and watched with a hypersensitivity. They shared sort of what it looks like to be in educational spaces where they don't look like the rest of the student body and feeling similar experiences. And so what we just talked about today in particular ahead of their visit was simply around the ask is not that you are doing anything differently. The only onus that we put on adults, and those are both white educators and educators of color, was to be hypersensitive to, as we often ask of them, to the experiences of our students and checking in. And that's both on an academic basis of what you're learning, what you're feeling, with the content that you're seeing, with the exhibits that you're experiencing, as well as sort of the interactions of patrons and MFA staff members.
Amanda?
Yeah, to hear you talk about the experience of authentic truth is so powerful for me. All we can ask, especially young students, to do is witness, I think, and be clear. And that itself can be so powerful in terms of holding these kinds of institutions accountable.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, again, we want to hear from you on this. Are you a person of color who's maybe felt unwelcome in a museum, theater, or other institution in Boston? Do you think our arts and cultural institutions are welcoming to all, or just to certain people? What do they need to do to be more inclusive? You can give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And so to that last question there, what do they need to do to be more inclusive in your view? I'll go to you, Amanda.
Sure. So I hear a lot when I work with museums and other arts organizations about their interest in and their commitment to diversifying audiences, which is fantastic, is huge, is so important. But I think this incident and others like it really show that it needs to go further, that it needs to be a practice of diversity maybe that is about staff training, is about hiring practices, it's about the internal facing components of the museum, because you can open the doors as wide as you want. You can invite as many people of color to whatever kind of shows that you have, but if they get there only to be unwelcomed, not to feel unwelcomed, but to be tangibly, materially, institutionally unwelcomed, it's not enough. It might even do more damage.
I want to take a call here. Dee is calling from West Roxbury. Dee, you have a story to tell us?
Yes, I do. I'm a BPS educator, and we took my students to the MFA. We walked there, and it was a kind of rainy, cold day. We arrived at the same time as these buses from the suburbs came, And they let the kids from the suburbs come in and sit in the lobby, but they told us we needed to come back until our the time that we were supposed to come in. So we had to take our students somewhere else so they could get out of the rain and cold until it was time for us to be let in. Then we went in. They did a fantastic job. They were split up in groups, and all the tour guides said they were great. And then we went to have lunch, and the kids were enjoying themselves, talking about their experience. And this gentleman came in, and he was a white staff member, and he started giving me a hard time, and I'm a black female, about how long we were in the cafeteria and that we didn't have the right to hang out there that long. I said, I'm sorry, was someone else coming in? Because I didn't know that. He goes, no, but you just don't have the right to sit here. And it just would not hear me, and then was trying to. And then meanwhile, some kids from the suburban school had spilled water up near the some of the pieces of art and all this other stuff. But he was more concerned that my students were, you know, were mainly black students and or Latino, were in the cafeteria longer than they were supposed to be. So the museum ended up, I filed a complaint, and they called me back about a week later. And whomever I spoke to was very nice, but I said, you know, they need to be trained on, you know, accepting differences and not making judgments. And, you know, the students that were there were all A students, AB students, right, and not right. that completely matters. And I suggested that they send him to our school because he made some statements about them and their education level, their academic level, like all just very ignorant, disrespectful things.
Did you feel satisfied with their response to your complaint?
I felt like they were just trying to make me happy. So not really.
Dee, thanks for the call. So Amanda, Devin, and Christella, you were all nodding your head there while Dee was telling her story. Just react to what she said.
So I thought to myself, so I really appreciated when, is it McCreary? Is that her name? Stated that this was an iterative process and that it involved accountability. And so as Amanda stated, you know, there are hiring practices that need to be done. But as Dee just stated, in addition to the hiring, that there's training and work that needs to be done in conversations, continued conversations, and particularly with gatekeepers in these institutions. And I think of security guards as gatekeepers. If these are the folks who are enforcing policies, these policies include, whether explicitly or implicitly, biases that affect the patrons of the institution. And so if those folks who are already hired are not getting that training and having those discussions to and speaking their truths, what we know is that whether or not you speak your truth, it comes out in practice. And your ability to speak your truth then allows for it to be this iterative process that involves many stakeholders within the institution, and that includes both patrons as well as staff and the directors that are involved.
And Christelle, what is it about these fine arts institutions and other institutions like the MFA that structurally makes them perhaps feel unwelcoming to people of color?
I mean, if we're being somewhat blunt, I mean, they were sort of inherently built by imperialists, right? These were built as structures to hold up and uphold a concept, an ideal world, white supremacy culture, right? Like the premise is in a Western mindset, right? Even in the exhibitions from Africa or other places, and there's the question of how these things even came to be in the museum in the first place, which is a whole other conversation. Ironically, one of the incidents happened in front of one of the exhibits about Africa. And the kids told the teacher they found that somewhat ironic, considering that their group was mostly black and brown. I will sort of add to this that the teacher's process of unpacking what happened with her students was writing letters. So the students wrote letters to the MFA that they plan to present with their expectations of what they want changed and the policies that they see that could improve a place like that for them. They never want other students to experience what they did.
Amanda?
Yeah, you're completely right. These are institutions that were founded to display the might of white Western empires. And I think we see that because security staff and other front of house staff in these museums are often predominantly people of color themselves. But because of the institutional history, the institutional practices, they still act on the behalf of this white supremacist everything. So it's not really about the color of the person who is speaking, the identity of the person who's doing these damaging actions, this practice of unwelcoming. It's about the structure that exists behind it, and that requires so much more than simply hiring more Black and Brown folks in your institution. It requires a deep practice of reflection. And it's been so reassuring for me to hear your language and a lot of the other language around this be about accountability instead of reconciliation. In my professional practice, consulting with museums, I often have to dissuade them from saying, we want a moment of reconciliation, because it just presumes a forgiveness on mm-hmm. the part of injured people of color. It needs to be about accountability. Accountability is a practice and an internal reflection, and reconciliation is an external expectation.
Lisa is calling from Roxbury. Lisa, what's on your mind?
Hi. I just want to... One, thank you for, you know, having this conversation. I'm also a public school teacher, and I deal with students in Boston who we know are, have a lot of, and a lot of times I find that their school experience is creates a space where a lot of re-traumatization is occurring, and as a district, we're not addressing that. And, you know, I've been in situations where I've experienced those types of macro and microaggressions, that you're discussing with, like, you know, at the zoo or at the MFA or, different spaces like that. And so there needs to be also some acknowledgement of, you know, the very few teachers of color that we have in the system are also, you know, experiencing that type of trauma and are also being re-traumatized in a system that doesn't, believe them a lot of times when they talk about situations that happen within the school system or within the school, or when they try to advocate for students of color who are raising their voices about situations in the school that are, you know, biased or unfair, or incidences of bias and unfair treatment that they feel are happening because of race.
Well, Lisa, thank you for your call. I want to squeeze in one more here before we get some final thoughts. The time has slipped away from us. Karen is calling from Brookline. Karen, what's on your mind?
Yeah, so I'm a health disparities investigator. I work at Boston Medical Center, and so very attuned to these issues. And I went to MFA on Monday, and I was so impressed by the exhibition on gender-bending fashion. And then there was a video installation on the history of the Black Panther movement in Boston. And just when I thought the MFA was kind of moving in the right direction, I'm just so saddened to hear this story and that this is what's happening at the MFA. And I just... at least it's opening the conversation. And I know at Boston Medical Center, we've done a program for our physicians called Bias Reduction in Internal Medicine, where we actually train people on microaggressions and, you know, how to reduce both our explicit and implicit bias.
Well, Karen, thank you so much for calling. And so in the final moments we have here, I'm wondering from each of you what the MFA can do moving forward to deal with what you were talking about earlier, Amanda, about not necessarily the reconciliation, but the public, the internal reflection.
Yeah, do the internal reflection. I certainly can envision what I might recommend to the MFA if it was a professional practice of mine.
Can you do that in 30 seconds?
No, I can't. all I can do is suggest that they do it.
Okay. Devin?
I think we've heard from Starbucks and H&M and these folks who have done a day, right, of practice. And the woman, Lisa, who called is talking about experiences that are lived over the course of weeks, months, and years. This is work that needs to be iterative, as she has already stated, and needs to continue for years and years to come if there's going to be any change made.
And WBUR arts reporter Cristela Guerra, where, of course, you'll be following this moving forward. So thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
Also, Devin Morris, Director of Student Family Engagement at Community Charter School of Cambridge. He's also the co-creator of the Teacher's Lounge, an event series for educators of color. Devin,
and
thank
friends.
You.
And friends.
And friends. And Amanda Figueroa. Did I get that right that time? Co-founder of Brown Art, Inc., which provides consulting and professional development to arts organizations, and a PhD candidate at Harvard. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
And listeners, thank you for calling in. And please visit our website, radioboston.org, and leave your comments there. We'd like to continue the conversation. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Jamie Bologna. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.